Shakespeare is freeing. Do you know what I mean? It can release you rather than hinder you. We all have this idea that, oh God, Shakespeare somehow is, it's in verse, so it's going to restrict us. Brian Cox, Judi Dench, they all kind of say, if you can get into it, rather than restrict you, it will free you.
Hello and welcome to Don't Be So Dramatic. I'm Steve Bradley.
And I'm Jason B. Moore.
Today we are joined by two guys who have produced something pretty extraordinary, if I do say so myself. We're going to talk about it today. It's called Muse of Fire and it's a documentary on Shakespeare. And we'll get onto that a bit later. But the two gentlemen we are joined by today are Giles Ferreira and Dan Paul.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us. Good to be here.
It's good to have you here.
Congratulations on the show.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Well, congratulations on your amazing feat of doing this documentary. It's come out brilliantly. We've both seen it and both
cool.
agreed
Thanks,
that
man.
It was incredible. So we'll get on to that in a moment. But just for anyone listening, give us sort of a brief insight, Dan first, of your career. Like, who are you? Where did you start?
Okay, so I grew up in Sheffield, moved to Cambridge when I was like 14, then moved to London when I started drama school, which is where I met Giles. Left drama school, and I've done a multitude of things. I did a lot of work straight out of drama school, doing lots of different plays. I did some TIE, I've done you know, all the stuff that everyone does, some commercials, some this, some that. I've done some nice plays at the Almeida, at the Royal Court, and we've done some stuff at the Globe, and some films, some TV. You know, I'm a jobbing actor for sure, you know.
Excellent.
And I still turn my hand to just about everything else that there is out there.
That's always
I've built sets, I've kind of like drawn sets, I've designed things, you know, I've done all those things. So I don't like to think of myself as a master of none, of course.
But, of course. Where did you both train?
Oh, we both went to Mount View.
Oh, really? Excellent. Mm. Excellent.
Some time ago now. I was thinking about that last night. Feels recent, yeah. But is it really 20 years?
Yeah, 95 we started.
Really?
We graduated in 98.
Oh, wow.
Don't laugh. I mean, that's like, you know.
No, just Dan shaking his head, looking out the window,
it's
thinking,
basically,
oh, no,
just
can't
look,
be.
I'm just looking out the window thinking,
yeah, where's it all
where
gone?
Did it go?
Yeah, it does go quickly, yeah.
It does go quickly, yeah. So if you're leaving drama school right now, work harder.
Because it'll something. Go quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise, it'll go quickly. Yeah.
Great. How about you, Giles? Where did it start for you?
I was born in London. Then we moved out to Hertfordshire, a town called Stevenage, which is about 27 miles north of London. Then I moved back to study, go to drama school, which is where I met Dan. Left drama school in 98. Came here to the National.
We're in the National. We're here, at the National right
we're,
now.
We're at the National Theatre. Worked here for about a year and a half. Then went up to Stratford and was at the RSC for about a year. And again, like that. And I've been here at the National on and off. Done some of the musicals in town. And I mean, I've just been sort of. I'm in a TV thing called Horrible Histories, which is on. Which has been on for about 5 or 6 years now. We just did season 6. So
yeah, I saw you on Facebook. Your costume, your period costume, looking very dapper. And
yeah. It's a different costume every day.
Every
it's
day,
like you're
yeah.
in, you're in either World
Was that
War
fun
One.
To
or,
do, though?
It's great fun. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's really the writing's brilliant. The company is very good. I mean, they've all won like BAFTAs and all the awards because they're fantastic. They're very, very funny. It's a dream job, really.
Yeah.
It's you go in, you always have a good time on the set, and you come out, and everyone loves it. The kids loved it. People are always Facebooking me saying, oh, I'm sitting watching it with my kids and we find it really funny.
Yeah.
And
so
you can't get...
The kids always recognise Giles. Everywhere we've been, the kids always recognise Giles.
You've got a fan base now going on for a long time.
Right, yeah.
You've got
and
the kids.
I'm not
Once you've got the kids,
much.
You've got it.
You know, I kind of do a little bit at the end usually of shooting. But actually this time they let me out. I'm usually doing like green screen stuff because the character that I play is like a Horrible History sports TV presenter, so I'm usually sat behind a desk with green screen and stuff, but this season they let me out and I was in costumes and
excellent
and could kind of get to mess around.
What were they thinking?
What were they thinking? So that's kind of me. And then last year I did we started Muse of Fire about 5 or 6 years ago, and there was a project here at the National that I also sort of organised and directed. So in the last couple of years, we've been sort of moving more towards telling stories as much as acting in them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Is that what was in Musify? Because this is where you actors get together and we're discussing Shakespeare and how you were taught Shakespeare as
Is that part of that? That was a specific week that we did, actually.
Oh, that was for the
which
film.
We can come to if you want, or we can talk about now.
Yeah, we'll come on to that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, cool.
So how did Muse of Fire come about? Where did the idea for this documentary...
He came back from Dublin. Was it Dublin?
Yeah.
And been doing a play and came back with this idea and said we should do something to try and dispel some of the myths or the fears surrounding Shakespeare and we should shoot it. I've been shooting like on and off like for like 15 years like as a cameraman when I wasn't acting as well. So I shot all sorts of things like Pimp My Ride in America. I shot stuff on and various random hoi polloi things that just existed out there. And so I had a camera. So because I had a camera, we'd sort of discuss the idea of shooting something instead of just writing a book or doing any of those sort of things. And then I guess from that, is that how we... I can't remember how it started. I think that's how it started.
Well,
look, I don't know who I am anymore. So, I mean, yeah. Yeah, basically, I think it was that. I think it was that. Have I made all that up?
No.
No one would know.
He's looking at me like, what are you talking about?
Go on.
So the idea is to dispel this myth of Shakespeare and it being so this scary thing that no one understands.
Because we were fortunate that we love Shakespeare, but that wasn't always the case. At drama school we had, there was a sort of number of things. Now that the film's out, it seems to kind of work in its essence of what we wanted to do. It's always quite difficult trying to make something, especially like a film, which is a kind of prolonged period of putting it together. But essentially, what we wanted to achieve, we sort of achieved, which is something which is very honest and very accessible that makes people say, I'll relook at Shakespeare, or I won't be afraid to go and have a look at Shakespeare. And that's kind of where we started from, the position of saying, well, we like Shakespeare. At drama school, we had a couple of good teachers who really kind of unlocked our passion for it. There was a film on at the same time, which was Al Pacino's documentary Looking for Richard, where he puts on a production of Richard III. Yes. It's like mid-90s.
Yes.
And he goes around like talking to the man on the street about getting Shakespeare. So there was that at the same time.
And then there was Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
Which kind of appeared in our second year, was it?
Yeah.
Which is actually interesting because you obviously talk about that a lot, and obviously you met him in the movie. And that's quite interesting that there are certain things that are turning points, like your teachers and like that, to demystify.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, I think, I can't remember because I did start to take notes in the movie, but I was enjoying it too much and I forgot.
Right answer.
Yeah. Is that there was this demystifying, and that it was written for the plebs, so to speak. And the two, there was two moments that in the movie, there was the prison in, but with
Berlin.
The Berlin, the Jamaican guy, I think he was. Yeah. That was quite special. And then the guy in America that you were driving past and you just saw this little tiny 80-seater fringe theatre.
Ed Corneli, yeah.
And that, those magic little, he says, I do one a year. Those quite special, and those moments are quite, you know, important. And I think, as well as Al Pacino's, Lenny Henry did that great TV thing as well. So it's great, it's sort of happening, and that you guys have sort of got on it on the perfect time as well, because to demystify it is, then you go, wow, this stuff's amazing.
I think what's interesting about it is, like, our idea wasn't specifically an original idea. You know, people have been writing and trying to demystify Shakespeare for a long time. And as Giles said, Al Pacino had done, you know, a really good film. You know, looking for it's a really good film. I loved it when I saw it. But I guess the thing is that we still felt a little bit like that was told from the point of view of someone who is a hugely successful actor who people revere as, and that's great. But what we wanted to try and do was cut through some of the other side of that, which is to go, we aren't anyone special. We really aren't. We're the guy, we're you, we're everyone. And let's see how we can discover this kind of together, which is all what happens in the best rehearsals with the best directors. You know, without getting too sort of actor-centric, you get into that place of going, we're learning together on this. You know, it's not like defined.
So for anyone out there who hasn't seen the documentary, give a quick summary of what it is. what its aim was to do. I know that's quite hard to do to summarize it, but not really. I'm just imagining the people are going, what is this documentary?
The film is a sort of journey of two friends who are actors.
An epic road trip odyssey.
And they go on a sort of road trip journey to try and find out as much as they can about Shakespeare from actors in the, from people who can do it really well, actors in the profession, directors, theatre companies. They also sort of, on their travels, talk to people on the streets, go into very, go out into society, into prison, into schools, to try and get from people outside of theatre what their perspectives are. And we see them go through it. So the kind of, the metaphor is that the kind of struggle that they're going through to try and get all this stuff done with just the two of them, no money, no budget, nothing, is kind of similar to the metaphor, the idea of putting yourself up against Shakespeare and saying, actually, you've got to roll your sleeves up, get stuck in, take a deep breath, be a bit brave. So you see these two guys struggling kind of against, battling against the odds, and hopefully in a really fun, exciting, energetic way, and then at the end, trying to bring it all together and say, are we still scared of Shakespeare?
Yeah, and I think you're talking about the normal thing about two guys, as you were saying earlier, two normal guys that happen to be actors. I think that's really portrayed well, because, you know, there's, you two guys are struggling, you're doing your tiling.
My tiling.
You know, you're late for your audition, and all this sort of normal life stuff is you're talking about while you're making this film. And which also helps people to understand that love it, we love this Shakespeare, we love this thing, but if we're actors, it's also a hard life as well. So to keeping that passion and loving it and
yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that we all have a perception, or the media has a perception, and therefore the public have a perception of what acting is. Like, they either think you do nothing, or they think you make tons of money and you're rolling around in Bentleys, you know, and maybe those two are things do exist at both extremes. I guess maybe they do, but the, from the majority of actors, they're trying to get work, they're trying to make enough money to live, they're, you know, working really hard at auditions, working on their voice, going to the gym, especially now in this kind of film-centric and Game of Thrones-centric world that we live in, you know. So all those things are factors that we all have to sort of tie in, but I guess, it's not like that. So we wanted to make sure that we represented, I suppose, acting and actors in a way that seemed appropriate. And that's what we are, so therefore... Yeah. You know.
And the Star Wars bit was great as well.
Say again?
The Star Wars bit was great as well.
Which bit? Which bit? The Star Wars bits littered everywhere. But again, that was a very conscious thing about storytelling. We were very concerned at the beginning that actually what we're dealing with is not Shakespeare... the institution or Shakespeare, the sort of academic side of it. We're interested in Shakespeare, the storyteller. So as much as we could, focusing on this man as a brilliant, brilliant storyteller with characters. And for us, our equivalent of that is Star Wars, is Indiana Jones, kind of movies.
And it's interesting, again, because all the people that you interviewed, you know, all the good and the great and all that sort of stuff, are all have the similar, not necessarily the same opinion of this the plays, the man, the stuff. But it's interesting. There seems to be, from the school situation which you talk about, to the sort of weird situation of, you mentioned some bad Shakespeare and some bad actors and directors possibly, to then the people that you're talking about. And I find that that's an interesting gap that is always put upon us as actors or directors or drama students, that we have to be doing our Shakespeare thing. But the guys that you're speaking to, obviously the big boys, are not having that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that to demystify that gap more than the school gap. And that's what I find interesting. And did you think about that side of things as well? Because it's a delicate side to think of. But
the key thing, which ties into your previous question, about, you know, we weren't necessarily saying, oh, acting is really, really difficult all the time, because sometimes, a lot of the time, it can be. Of course, you've got to put yourself through drama school, then you've got to get out there, then you've got to try and hustle, you've got to try and do it, of course. But acting is also, can be really fantastic, and also that's why we go into this business, because we want to do all that.
And that's why we're still here as well, to be fair.
But the thing is that we knew that if the audience was going to buy and get anything out of the film, they would have to accept the two protagonists, if you like, who are up on the screen, and all the programmes that we'd kind of seen previously and come up with might be BBC documentaries on Shakespeare, and the way that they're presented can often put you off, because if you've some, you know, professors talking about, you know, blah 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 in 16th Shakespeare with, immediately you're like, I don't know what's going on, there's something between me and that experience. And we knew, okay, well, if the audience is not going to have that, they're going to have to completely buy these two people that they're seeing, who we're asking them to go on a journey with. And that was why we kind of said, well, we'll show everything, we'll just make it as honest as possible. And at the same time, to your current question, the actors, we also wanted to present in as an honest a way as possible, because a lot of them, as you say, great actors, they've all spoken about Shakespeare a lot, they've all spoken about actors, they've all been on Inside the Actor's Studio in a sort of very specific way. And what we wanted to do is say, let's see Judi Dench or Ian McKellen in a completely honest, bare way, so that people watching it wouldn't feel, oh, they're a huge actor on a pedestal, and therefore I'm at one remove. They'll think, oh, right, Ewan was scared of Shakespeare, and therefore, okay, it's all right for me to be.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we were coming from in all of the sort of presentation, the way we sort of presented it.
And one of the things that helped us to do that was literally to turn up with just us. You know, we didn't have a big crew. In fact, there was one time, I think one of the very first interviews we did, where we turned up with, you know, a photographer and another camera operator and another assistant, and it was just honestly a bit crap. It was just a bit like, actually, suddenly you're a filmmaking team, and actually what we wanted was to get that intimate connection to the interviewee. And we realized that if we were going to do it properly, we would have to just turn up with ourselves, set everything up, let it roll, and just be us two asking questions. And instantly, within about 2 or 3 minutes of everyone who we spoke to, even if there was a little bit of concern about what we were doing, it went, because it was like us talking right now. And that is, I think, the thing which would come away from the film and go, so one thing we did brilliantly, I think, if we're saying anything good about what we did, is to just take away that part of it, make it real.
Well, I think it sort of shows in that, because in all the interviews, it does look like you've just rocked up and just gone, oh, do you want to chat?
Yeah.
You know,
we had.
Yeah, we had. Exactly, yeah. You know, but again, that all comes from having someone just walked past the window that I knew. Easily distracted, sorry. Having an understanding of what our audience is going to be experiencing. And it was always in the back of our heads to say, okay, well, we must try and make this accessible to people and try and not put people off, so that when you're watching it, you don't think, oh, I don't connect to this. You feel the opposite. Yeah. You think, oh, right, I feel like that.
Yeah.
Or I get that. I get what they're talking about.
Yeah.
That's always what we're after, you know.
Because I think I am stereotypically exactly the person that this documentary is aimed at. Because I am the person that is like, nah, Shakespeare, no.
It's funny how many people have said that. Yeah. Until this morning,
really?
Someone said exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And you kind of think, well, why don't we just all admit this and kind of get over it?
And actually, you're right. That's the one thing. It's like, and you get that from all, I mean, the extended interviews that aren't in the film will be available for free soon. And the thing that you get from all of those is exactly that, is that we all have a little bit of an issue with it, actually, or a little bit of a resistance or something to it, but we all pretend not to have.
You're scared.
Yeah.
The best, one of the best bits, which was great, was the dum-de-dum-de-dums. That was just absolutely great. And because when I first directed by Shakespeare, I was absolutely petrified, because I thought, I'm going to stand in front of a load of people and know exactly what they're talking about. And I wrote a whole dictionary of all the words I didn't understand. I never actually used it, because thank God they knew what I was talking about. But it is that. And there were certain times I was going dum-de-dum-de-dum in my head and thinking, that doesn't rhyme at the end. And do I need to make that rhyme just for the sake of it?
Yeah.
So, and especially that, I think that was the moment when you're here at the National with your actors and there's one actress, and I can't remember her name, and says,
Lucy,
the dum-de-dum, God, yes, and it took her right back. And that's the dum-de-dum, I think, is a big thing that people close the book and go, thank you very much.
Well, people remember that from school. Like, if you remember nothing else about Shakespeare, they remember dum-de-dum-de-dum, and they're not quite sure what dum-de-dum-de-dum means, but they know that it, well, as Lucy said, you know, oh, that's what Shakespeare is, miss. That's what Shakespeare means to me. So, yeah, I mean, it's about trying to kind of get through that part of it and actually get down to what it really is, which is actually storytelling at this very, very base level. you know.
It's hard because that's what nothing, no other drama that we have, modern drama, modern films, aren't written in verse in that way. There is no meter to it. Everything's prose, everything's, that's the way we speak now. Shakespeare being like the thing that he is, you have to have Shakespeare, and therefore you have to have this meter that goes with it. And a lot of the time people just don't know how to deal with it. So it kind of becomes this elephant in the room, which is, it's there, but we don't know how to do it. And then you have a thing where someone says, oh, I do, I have the answer to this, I know how to do it. And then someone else says, no, I have the answer to it.
Yeah.
So we kind of wanted to bring together all of those, and then the audience could look at it, if you were that inclined, if you're an actor or something, and you can kind of go, oh, well, how Mount Rylance looks at it, that makes sense to me, or how John Barton does it, that makes sense to me. So again, it was important that we kind of drew together as many of those different voices and ideas as possible.
And we had a really interesting moment, like, I guess Melvin Bragg said something which is really interesting, is about how different European countries embrace certain things, like, you know, opera or art, or, and we have literature. Like, we have, that is our, you know, USP, for want of a better phrase, unique selling point. But yet, we're still caught up in this kind of thing of not being brave enough to really be proud of our literature and to go, if we're not understanding it, why aren't we understanding it? And let's change this. Let's let every person leave school understanding Shakespeare.
That's so true. Yeah.
Because that empowers everything.
Yeah, and especially when you then go to America and talk about the Americans doing Shakespeare. And Bonnie Greer talks about it. And then, but the woman in the shop says, oh, no, we're Americans. We don't do things like that. And it's just, you think, oh, wow. Well, we're the same language. And actually, you think it would be a little bit easier in American because it's, you know,
it's just softer
and not so, I suppose, pompous in a way.
But exactly. I mean, there were a lot of Americans. I mean, there were Americans that were like anyone who, you know, this person didn't necessarily understand it. But they're equally there. When you spoke to some of the younger people who were studying at school, they were really good at it. Like, they were really good at understanding it. Their grasp of the language. This is the one girl in the street who's very brief, but we had to cut her because she went on for like 10 minutes and she quoted. Yeah, she just went through it.
Yeah.
She's incredible. And she knew it. But she knew it in a way that meant she really understood it. And so they are actually quite good at it, and they're not afraid of it necessarily as much as we are, because it doesn't have the connotation that it does over here to us. It's like, it's high art literature over here. Over there, it's something else that they learn at school.
Yeah.
That has a reference to here, but it's slightly
we're almost
different.
Pressured in this country, aren't we, with it?
And
that's where the resistance comes from. Yeah.
There's a kind of cultural baggage that we have that the Americans don't have.
Yeah.
So you have this brilliant thing where every state will have a Shakespeare festival in the year. So we knew when we were going over to America that we could kind of pick any state and there'd be something there.
There are 42 festivals, aren't there, in America of Shakespeare?
The
interviews that we had, we knew we'd be able to go to Boston to do something there. We knew we had to go to Virginia, and we knew we had to go to LA. So we would just find, you could just find the relevant festival, the relevant companies, because they're not afraid of it in the same way that they're more willing to sort of have a go at it.
Yeah.
And there are less consequences, seemingly, because we have more of a cultural baggage that goes with.
And as you say, you mentioned earlier, we found ourselves upon this lovely little place called the Stage Loft Theatre Company, and that was a great moment for us because it was total chance. We pulled off to get some sleep. We checked into a motel where our credit card got cloned, as it turned out. Didn't find out for a couple of days on that one. And then we went for a little drive to get some food. Couldn't find anyone. And as we went down this road, we were like, look at that, there's a theatre. So we literally just pulled off and knocked on the door. And that guy, Ed Cornelius, who was a lovely man, is a really good friend of ours now, and he literally sort of spoke for, I guess, small town America, you know? He spoke for the importance of what it meant for him because of what it meant for his, I guess, community. And it kind of echoed lots of things that were in the film for us, I think.
Not only that, he was just seemed like a really passionate man about wanting to give this, whatever his theatre does besides the Shakespeare.
Yeah,
really passionate man about trying to do that.
And passionate, as you say, about theatre, you're right. Yeah,
passionate about theatre generally. So the movie itself, right? So you decided to do this thing. I mean, clearly we see what happens, but
sure. But
did you just think, oh my God, how are we going to do this? I mean, you say that in the movie, how are we going to get these people? But
well, we just started.
How did the people start coming then, besides what we see?
We just started. I mean, Giles contacted Ian first, wasn't it?
Yeah, Ian was first, and we just got a list of actors that we knew that we could talk to and say, could you come and speak to us about this subject? And then if we could get half a dozen of those, then you could go to a BBC or a Channel 4
yeah.
and say, right, give us some money to go and do the thing which we want to do, which is going out and talking to ordinary people. And then, so we wrote to those people, Ian being the first, and Ian got back and said, yes, brilliant. He said, it sounds ambitious, but count me in, count me in. And once he said yes, we said, okay, well, we'll approach the rest of the people on the list. And then once they all started saying yes, we said, okay, well, why don't we try and get as far as we can with this on our own?
But we did also have that moment of when we spoke to Ian. I remember after sort of 4 hours of Sir Ian, of coming away and going, oh, wow, this is incredible. We actually, because we had a plan for it, but we were like, wow, we really need to get this out of there because this is so, so good. We don't just want it to be one YouTube video. You know, no disrespect to YouTube, but we want it to be more reaching than that, actually, and have a different sort of, a slightly different agenda on it. Sorry.
Yeah.
So it
was a case of, I mean, we've sort of spoken about this a lot, but it's a case of having a really clear idea about what it is that you're actually aiming at. And if you can, about what you're going to try and attempt, at least. And if you can be clear about what it is you're trying to attempt, to say, okay, then you can communicate that to an Ian McKellen. Because you can't, yeah. You can't ask Ian McKellen to do something like this unless you know exactly what you want him to do. Otherwise, yeah. It's disrespectful. So if you've got a clear idea about what it is you want, then you can communicate to the people. And we found that if we could bypass the agents and the...
Most definitely.
Yeah.
And all of the representatives and all that, communicate to the actors what it is we wanted to do, then they said, okay, well, yeah, this sounds like a great idea. Come to the house, come to the theatre, we'll talk. And so we just started and tried to get as far as we could, tried to be as honest as we could with people. And people, in return, were very honest back.
And we had lots of times where we were, whilst all this was going on, we were approaching lots of different companies as well, you know, because obviously we knew there'd become a point where we need to get it either broadcast or have to find a way of, put in brackets, selling it so it could reach people. And everyone we spoke to, and we spoke to a lot of people, everyone had a view on it and said, oh, it's a great project, we really want to get involved in this. But the long and the short of it is that actually you have to sometimes do these things on your own, and they were always looking for a finished product to sell because they still weren't totally sure what our film was going to be, even though we were.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where Giles and I said, you know what, we'll keep having these meetings, we'll still go and see all these people, we'll still keep trying to proliferate the film out there the best we can, but let's just keep going and let's just keep speaking to these people and keep making the movie we want to make. And at some point, hopefully, these lines will come together and we'll be in a position to be able to offer this product to something which we're really proud of, which is the film we want to make. And then they won't be able to tell us what they want it to be.
Because it would have already been something.
Yes, because it already had its life. It already existed in the style we want it to be. And they couldn't really get involved and manipulate it too much.
Mm.
Not that everyone does that, but that was always our fear, that someone was going to come on board and go, oh, yeah, we just want to see all of this.
Yeah.
We just want to do all of this. And, yeah.
So I've got a couple of questions. What was it like going to Denmark, in that section where you go to Denmark and you go to see Hamlet with Jude Law? Because that looked an absolute... And the way he describes it in that interview of just being outdoors and, you know, looking out at the stars and that... I mean, amazing experience for him to be able to do that. But what was it like going there? Because
it was amazing.
It was amazing.
When else... I don't know when else I would be able to say, oh, I'm going to go to Elsinore Castle.
No.
I mean,
no.
I've been to Denmark, but to go to Elsinore Castle is like extraordinary.
And also, we sailed. We went on the boat because we were like, apart from the fact we didn't have any money, but we knew we needed to get Kit out of there. So we were like, why don't we catch the boat? Because that's what Shakespeare would have done.
That's what Hamlet does.
Yeah.
Hamlet gets sent from Denmark to England and then he comes back again. So we thought, well,
do the trip.
Jude didn't do that. Jude got the plane.
We drove on there and had a car fire and all sorts of things.
We were like in Hamlet's footsteps. So it took us ages to kind of get there, and then we drove there.
It was 18 hours on the boat. It's ridiculously
18
long.
Hours on the boat.
Yeah, ridiculously long.
But from England,
from Harwich, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You'd think it would take like Calais
2 hours or 3 hours or something. Yeah, yeah. It's
but
like
no,
18 hours.
You're going up and then you're going down. But Michael Grandage at the Donmar was great. He was behind the project right from the beginning, and he said, "Yeah, you can come and see us." And Jude was brilliant about giving us an interview and granting us access. As busy as they were at that time, they're about to go to Broadway and do the production there.
Yeah,
but they were all fantastic and very generous. So for us, it couldn't have been better. Really, we saw the production. In being in that environment,
yeah,
knowing that Kenneth Branagh had taken his production there, Derek Jacobi had taken his production there, Olivier had taken his production, and you're right there in Elsinore Castle, and hearing Hamlet, seeing Hamlet, it was like a highlight.
You know, and Geraldine James sums up really well. You know, looking up at the patterned roofs and seeing what this could have looked like as it's written.
Yeah.
It's like, it's totally right. And Jude saying, "Look up and see the star," and it's
physically doing it.
Yeah.
And what was brilliant is that what you see in the film, there's a little bit where we speak to people outside of the and there's outside of the castle as they're waiting to go into the production that evening, and they were great and really funny. And we spoke to one woman. We spoke to lots of them, but we spoke to one woman who said that Hamlet, that Shakespeare really nails the Danish sensibility, the Danish frame of mind. And again, that was something we were really interested in seeing in different countries, how Shakespeare spoke to different cultures and different mindsets and languages. And when we went to Spain,
I know, it echoed everywhere
exactly
we went.
The same, yeah.
And that was really moving. Because we sort of had a hunch that must be the case. Shakespeare's universal. But to hear people saying it, you kind of get the feeling that if you went to the North Pole, you'd see an Eskimo saying, no, Shakespeare must have been an Eskimo.
And everyone thinks he understood like the Danish mindset, the Spanish mindset, the French mindset, the American mindset. But actually what he did was just understand people or human. The human, he just understood it. I mean, Harold Bloom talks about that, but he understood people, and therefore his stories speak globally because
yes, because there's a town in Italy where they believe that Shakespeare was Italian,
right?
Because he writes so much in Italy, and they say he writes the Italian, has the Italian fire, you know, and so there's a whole town saying, no, he was Italian.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that in Denmark, the lady specifically says Shakespeare understood the Danish sort of mindset, the frame of mind. And in Spain, he says that Shakespeare, it's the passions, the emotions of the Spanish that Shakespeare gets. And you kind of think, well,
But it references like how those countries operate anyway. That's what's fascinating. Like the fire, the heart, the mind, the kind of... You know, I'm sure in Germany. I mean, we spent a lot of time in prisons, but I'm sure if we asked the general German on the street, it would mean something to them, which was probably tied into engineering. I don't know, but you know, organization. Yeah,
exactly.
There you go. Exactly.
Ulysses' speech in Troilus and Cressida about order.
Yeah, order
would be what they cite.
So you know, that was amazing. All of that stuff, and going back to Denmark, and that was our first real experience of finding out about that, and then it just started to duplicate everywhere we went to. So
we went into a bar when we were there after the production, after the performance, and I don't think I'd seen a black person for a while.
That one.
So it was a little bit like, you know, in the westerns when the sort of the piano stops. Yeah. It was a little bit like that.
You went up to the bar. Okay, do you remember this? You went to the bar to get a drink, and you came back. You went, did you see that? Like, because they sort of like. They kind of made a point of Giles not being welcome at the bar.
Yeah,
I sort of bounded over there the next time I got drinks like a bowling ball, and I'm like, no, sorry, you're not getting away with that, and just sort of like parted the seas with them all, and just kind of like, because it was so confusing, like we hadn't come across that.
But that's also part of being like, you know, even like when you were talking about being in America and at Ed Corneli's Stage Loft Theatre, again, a sort of 6'4" bald white guy and a sort of small black guy.
Traditionally would be known as a gangbanger in Florida,
basically,
probably.
Do you know what I mean? Everywhere we stood out. Basically, no matter where we went, we kind of stood out.
But
and
it's
I think
interesting,
that was...
I mean, to talk about, because Lenny Henry did his big speech at BAFTA about culture and black people and Asian people in films. You talking about Romeo and Juliet in the film, about the guy playing Mercutio.
Yeah.
And never the first time you see a black person playing Shakespeare. is again, that's an interesting thing to see other people of different of other colours playing
right.
Shakespeare now, and it does happen a lot more right. now than it used to. But it's still people.
But it's still thematic though.
See, like... generally. English, British, white people doing Shakespeare,
yeah.
and than any other culture, and people go, oh, that's interesting. The only other, only character that you'll definitely see a black person is Othello, and the rest is so. I suppose in an interesting way, people, especially in maybe in America, seeing a tall, bald white guy and a small black guy talking about Shakespeare, that's sort of odd.
Yeah,
because it's not normal.
And we've sort of did play on that.
We embraced that. Yeah,
you know, you're not. You yeah. don't. Necessarily look Shakespearean actors. Do you yeah, know what I mean? No. So that's
the ghost in the darkness we called ourselves.
Yeah, the ghost in the darkness.
Because basically, lie to us was always quite tricky.
It was always a nightmare.
Giles would either be in a bit too much shadow, or you couldn't see my face. Or his basically his face or my face. One of us would lose pretty much most.
But
of the
it's
time.
Interesting, you know. It sort of yeah. turns it a bit as well.
Yeah, I mean, again, it comes back to storytelling. I did a production of Hamlet here, and after the production, I was going across the foyer, and a guy. Called out, fantastic, brilliant job. Of course, you know Horatio wouldn't have been black. But well done anyway. And I was like, oh, okay.
You thanks. Give and you take away.
Thanks, yeah. yeah. But then I'm like, well, Rory Kinnear isn't Danish, you understand that. And he's not a prince. We're dealing with stories. I mean, that's a whole world. But again, from our perspective, we weren't focusing on Shakespeare, the storyteller. And anything that we could do to sort of bring it back to that, that's what we did. So we kind of embraced the fact that we are who we are.
And we also grew up on a sort of diet of Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. Okay, and those guys were the two oddities of, like, for anyone who doesn't know, they were two comedy actors, but comedy actors as well.
And they'd been really good at Shakespeare as well.
Of course they would have been. They'd have been amazing at Shakespeare. Like, I mean, imagine? Gene Wilder would have still destroyed it today. But the point is, like, they were always the oddities that the kind of the stuck out that were always a bit... fumbling, and we love that. And there's something which we sort of saw ourselves not as that, but like as those kind of energies that are allowed to just try and get away with whatever we could all the way through making this film. And you know, you push in a nice way, and if someone says no, you go, okay, fine. Yeah. But you can ask.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And again, this the idea of our differences or race or how racial casting again is something which you have to be able to put your hand up and talk about. And that comes to fundamental to this film, the whole project.
Yeah.
You have to be able to put your hand up and say, I have this question. There is no wrong question. And so if that includes that side of things, the racial side of things, then that's all to the good as far as we're concerned, because that's fundamental to what the project is.
Yeah.
It's not being afraid to talk about these things, not being afraid to address these things. So if we can kind of touch on that a little bit, then we're happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think, well, one of the barriers, I think, with the whole Shakespeare is the language. And Ewan McGregor says one thing in your documentary about when you speak the words, he describes it as a taste, doesn't he? He said it tastes really good in your mouth. Like, and I thought that was a really interesting way of describing it. Like, you get satisfaction with saying it. But it's if people like for me as well, like being afraid to approach the language because you don't understand it. Like, how would you get around that barrier with people? Because, like, I mean, I think the documentary really helps people to break down that wall for people that are afraid to. But I just thought that was a really nice thing that he described it as people.
Well, it seems that one of the things that is the common thing or the thing that you see in rehearsals or you see in our workshop that we did. We did a week of workshop at the National Studio where we had practitioners from Ian McKellen to Bonnie Greer, various other people come in and work with us. And John Barton actually as well. Is that it's a language that isn't necessarily how we talk today, so how we speak today. So it requires straight off the bat a set of different muscles. Like it does require that, you know, you have to train yourself to be able to be in that position where you can use your mouth as quickly as that, and you can use your tongue as quickly as that. And I think that Jude is exceptionally brilliant at it. Like his ability to connect his thought, the speed of his thinking, to the speed of his delivery of his language is, I mean, second to none. It's quite unique. And And so I guess the first thing you have to do is be able to use your mouth quickly. You know, we're putting it really, really simply. Be able to use your mouth quickly so you can actually do, A, what the script's demanding. That doesn't necessarily answer the whole question, but there are lots of those things along the way, aren't there?
So it's thoughts there, but thought not getting in the way and just allowing and letting.
Instead of getting
yourself stuck in the way.
Yes, right.
Yeah. There are lots of elements to this, but yes, of course, if you have to be able to understand the thoughts, you have to be able to connect the thoughts to your mouth quickly. And the one thing that we you know, people say doesn't work and we observe doesn't work is when you're thinking as a Shakespearean actor and you're playing your thinking because you're speaking slower. Jude doesn't do that. He rattles through, but because he's speaking the speed that he's thinking, and that's essentially what it is. Essentially, in so much of Shakespeare, the thoughts are being vocalized, in that moment,
which gets rid of that wonderful expression "I'm doing my Shakespeare." It just gets rid of the doing of and just doing it.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of elements to this. I mean, you jump in because I know that there's so many parts to this question to answer, but that's the one thing I think initially as actors you have to be able to have the muscularity to,
because he's articulating. Ewan's articulating at that point something which a lot of the other actors articulated, which is that somehow it's Shakespeare is freeing, do you know what I mean? It can release you rather than hinder you. We all have this idea that, oh God, Shakespeare somehow it's in verse, so it's going to restrict us. Brian Cox, Judi Dench, they all kind of say, if you can get into it, rather than restrict you, it will free you. And how that speaks to today is that we don't get the opportunity to use to speak. It's not necessary. We text, click, like, share,
and we're sloppy. And we're sloppy in our chat.
We don't have to speak. See you later. See you in a bit. Lol. Whatever. We don't actually need to speak. And in the same way as you were saying, we're not encouraged to think. You were talking about the system that your friend has developed for memory, for training actors to kind of use their memory. How often do we hear that human beings only use 20% of their minds? Shakespeare's characters not only think, as you were saying, at the speed of light and in a really dexterous way. You think of Hamlet, who can think in a million different directions at once, and also can tie his expression of that thought to it. And so you have these kind of extraordinary moments of expression, so that when we get to do that today, it's extraordinary and it can be really freeing. The problem is talking about it, which is kind of what we're doing now. So it's a kind of catch-22 because you want to get to the point where you're just doing it. Ewan was talking about what we don't quite see in that bit of our video, but what he was talking about, which if you go on and see the whole video, you'll be able to see, is him feeling restricted going into rehearsals and kind of allowing his thoughts to kind of tie him in knots right at the beginning of rehearsals and getting to a point where he could just let all that go. And that's why it tasted good, because once he got his mouth around it, once he got his brain around it, he was off, he was away.
And there's something to be said for knowing that you're going to be working on a Shakespearean production, because you know, at the best you might get 6 weeks to rehearse. Well, if you've been doing lots of TV and you've been doing lots of contemporary plays where you haven't had to use that level of muscularity, you're going to be running to keep up, potentially. Or you could be, unless you're really, really experienced. And so... You know, you hear, like, for example, when Tom Edelston played Cassio or was in Coriolanus, you know, he knew he was going to be playing that role for quite a while. He had enough time to absolutely be off book, knowing it like the back of his hand before day one of rehearsals. And that helps. Let's be under no illusion. That helps because you absolutely can then just play. And you can then have those volleys of badminton or tennis or whatever you want the, you know, analogy to be. It's like, it's simply going, you know, I'm playing, and I can enjoy playing, and I'm not being caught up in the fear of going, what's my line? What's my line? Or even, I'm not sure I understand my line. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You still make discoveries, but you're making discoveries in the moment of saying it and how it affects you through the muscularity and through all those things. I mean, as I say, you can get caught up in talking about this, and it's so difficult because it can sound like such a dick. Sorry, but it's all of those things, and that's why it's a hard thing to talk about.
I think, you know, we can talk forever and sound like dicks, yeah. But I think the actual...
Do I sound like a dick?
Thank you so much. is the taste, and you literally clicked, you know. Once you've got that, you can't really... you can talk about it more, but because the click's there, you... don't yeah. need to. You're then yeah. doing it and playing it and enjoying
and
it.
And that's why that one little bit of Ewan McGregor saying that is in there, because it summed up all of the stuff we've just been trying to verbalise.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's he sums it up. It is that thing. It's that when it works and everything's just right, it's a taste that just occupies that space.
And then you're on that sort of enjoying it and having a great time and playing with it, being stupid with it.
Exactly. Being just, free.
Yeah, free. Yeah.
The freedom that it gives you. And again, that underlying metaphor of us trying to kind of pit ourselves up against this project. It's not about Dan and Giles. It's about these two people who are going on this journey. And once we kind of get through that barrier of actually we can do this. We've managed to get to Ian McKellen. Wow, great. We've managed to go over to Denmark or wherever it is. You know, result. It's the same kind of thing. If you can get through that barrier, that restriction, then you're away. And Shakespeare's like
I
that.
I think that's right, you being the two protagonists. It's actually, just now it just came to my mind, it literally is the way you two have done the movies. You've literally said, come with me, mate, take my hand, it'll be all right, don't worry, it'll be fine. We might be a bit scary, but it won't be that scary.
Yeah.
And you have that. I mean, you know, you're having a wee in the middle of the desert or something, you're doing all sorts of weird things, and you're doing your tiling, you know what I mean? And that... Yeah. That is that's the
yeah.
But that's also what rehearsals should be about as well. That sort of stupidness.
Absolutely.
I'm doing my tiling. I'm having a wee. You know, that's so. Then you can, you know.
And that's the problem, isn't it? We kind of, when we get roles, unless you're working all the time, and even if you are, you know, it's a great opportunity, and you can get caught up in going, I've got to do a really good job. I've got to do a really good job. I've got to do a really good job, and actually thinking about that too much. Yeah, exactly. Instead of actually discovering and finding those answers together as a group and, you know, and then being secure in that. I mean, there are obviously lots of productions that find that and lots of rehearsal spaces that find that. But it's what you look for as an actor, isn't it? That comforting space where you go, great, we can trust where we are right now and we can make this together, actually.
Mm. But it's good that you say that, because that, in a way, is where... the whole Muse of Fire things come from. I mean, that's a title and we like the title, but there is actually some thought behind it, which is, as you say, we're kind of saying, okay, come on this journey with us, which is exactly what that speech is about at the beginning of Henry V, you know, Oh, from Muse of Fire, that would have said, on your imaginary forces work. The prologue, the chorus comes out and talks directly to the audience. On your imaginary forces work, think when we speak of horses that you see them printing their proud hooves in the receiving earth. For it is your thoughts that now must deck our kings, carrying them here and there, turning the accomplishments of many years into an hourglass. That's exactly kind of what we did, of saying, you're going to have to do some work as well, audience. You can't be passive with Shakespeare. If you're passive with it, you're not going to get anything out of it. And it's the same kind of...
Yeah.
That's what we kind of wanted to have with the film.
Trust us.
Trust us.
Trust us.
Come with us. Be prepared to kind of turn your brains on. You can't just sit back with it. But and that's the same with life, in a way, on a kind of a sort of slightly more lofty way. Again, it's kind of wanting to tie those things in. You can't be passive about it. Roll your seat, which is why it's nice when young filmmakers or actors come and say, oh, you know, it made me want to get up and go out and do Shakespeare or make a film or do my own thing.
Actually, watched it last night and actually started to read Romeo and Juliet again. It was very inspiring. And the love that Judy Dench got Muse of Fire wrong. That was brilliant as well.
Say again?
I love that Judy Dench got Muse of Fire speech wrong, because again, normal.
Right. Yeah, and actually, what's lovely, it's really nice to hear you say that, because we've had so many people who you wouldn't ever imagine would ever even pick up a play, who picked it up and read it. Like my dad. Like, my dad was a professional golfer. Like, he went, oh, I'm actually gonna pick up a play and have a little read. I'm like, wow, like, you know, and it's so. Although it appeals to other people, like, it also has this sort of, hopefully, this thing that just cuts through different age groups for different reasons.
And also not just us in our massive bubble,
acting world.
It's going where it should go, which is what it was originally written for.
Yeah. Even if you feel you don't like Shakespeare, that, you know, it's as much for those people as it is for anyone sitting here in the National Theatre, because actually chances are that if you kind of see the right production, or if you read the right bit, even if it isn't the whole play, if you read the right scene, you're going to find something which chimes with your life and your experience, which could help you in some way. And that's kind of all we're after. We're not after saying, this is how you do it. We're after saying, if people could watch a film and then say, I'm going to have a go at something, or the next
doesn't have to be Shakespeare, even, actually.
Doesn't have to be Shakespeare.
You know,
could be anything you want.
Yeah. And there's something which is, like, which can't be underestimated either, is that how grateful we are to everyone that took part, because we've got... It wouldn't have been a film. If all these people hadn't have given their time for free, we wouldn't have had this film. And, you know, every single person gave up time, or they gave up work, or they gave, you know, from all those brilliant actors who were involved, not because they're a name, because they're a famous person, but because they're really good at Shakespeare, or they've got something to say, or they're just brilliant actors.
Well, you could actually see that it was no ego in the sense that we were famous. There was no famous thing within it. And at the end, just at the end of the film, you have lots of little clips of lots of the people that I think, oh my God, they weren't even in the movie. Like Alan Cumming's not in it, and Rory Kinnear's a tiny bit. And you just think, oh God, there's another movie.
I mean, try cutting 450 hours into an hour and a half. It's like, it's just.
But it just goes to show that it's not just actors talking about acting. They actually want to get this out, because the whole point of us doing what we do is not to show off so much, is get out there and communicate. And it's not a case we need to tell you how to do Shakespeare or any play. Mm. It's to get out and do it and share these long stories. Exactly. That is the Hamlet story is still happening. It's the same story. You know, some guy's father died, and the weird, you know, stepfather, uncle situation.
Right.
Not sure everyone's going through that, but those situations are still happening now, you know.
Yeah, right. It's so true, yeah.
And the sense that actually that isn't something, that's not something which kind of starts and stopped with us. We were inspired by Al Pacino doing exactly the same thing, or Baz Luhrmann. When we spoke to him, he elaborated on what his process was and what he wanted to achieve in doing Romeo and Juliet. Or other films like Gandhi. Got to talk about Richard Attenborough, who passed away, who we wrote to speak to, and he was kind of keen, but he was ill. And that's what he did. He got up. He worked for 20 years to put Gandhi together.
George Lucas. I mean, they've all these great
Orson Welles, whoever
people,
it is.
Yeah, it's
about kind of doing what we've had the opportunity to have done to us for other people. Mm. Just trying to pass it along a bit. So in that sense, it's very clear to see. It's actually not about. That's what I mean about. It's not about Dan and Giles. It's actually about, as you quite rightly said, just passing something along, which is somehow helpful or useful in some way. And if we can do that, then...
And if people hadn't have enjoyed it, it would have been the most horrible thing, because the one thing is, yes, you want information there, but you want it to be fun. Like, we wanted it to be fun. Like, we... Humour is the one thing that connects us to so much, and me especially, you know, to so much in this world. And without feeling like people could be sort of laughing a little bit at certain things, you know, then what is there? It's just another cold, dry documentary about something that people struggle with, you know, to all intents and purposes. So, yeah.
So, if that doesn't make you want to buy the documentary...
buy it is funny, and it should be moving and thought-provoking, at least.
So, and it's not very expensive either.
Well, yeah, tell people out there where they can get hold of the documentary. Where
okay, so the easiest way to find it is just to go to our website, and go to... The easiest one is to remember shakespearefilm.com. Shakespearefilm.com. Don't know why anyone hadn't brought that before, but
no,
it's available. And then you can just click through to the iTunes on there, and you can go, it'll take you straight to it. Or you can get it on Vimeo on demand, which has three more subtitles than the iTunes section does. So it's available in 11 countries, basically, with subtitles. And also the interviews are going to be available in their entirety in about 4 weeks. And the easiest way to find those will be interviews.museoffirefilm.co.uk.
Excellent.
And these interviews are like incredible. I mean, the film is an hour. The film was like an hour and 20 minutes long, and most of these interviews, of which we have about 100, are an hour long each.
Wow.
Some of them are like an hour and a half.
Mark Rylance is 2 hours. Michael Boyd is an hour. I mean, they're just.
Ian McKellen's is like over 2 hours.
Yeah.
They're extraordinary. In putting Fantastic. The film together, we'd be kind of going through saying, right, we need to find 30 seconds of Ralph Fiennes, and you'd end up watching an hour of the interview because they're just...
And then you go, what are we gonna take?
They're just extraordinary.
Yeah, we'll just put that little bit in there. Oh, that's 45 minutes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you kind of know what the line is, and things kind of... It's like, well, that can't Sudoku in there. But the point is that the interviews are so... We found them anyway, so rich and fascinating. And what was great is that during the course of doing the interviews, we kind of got less crap at them, because like, to begin with, neither of us are Parkinson, neither of us are like Graham Norton, and so we sort of be there and you get a bit nervous and it's like, oh my god, I'm in front of Ralph Fiennes, and
we were like sticks covered in concrete,
so basically. Watching the whole interview was kind of a bit cringy, but we got less crap at them and more able to just stand back and let the interviewee do the talking. So when you watch them now, it's just people who are so passionate about Shakespeare, they've spent 30 years, 50 years, 60 years immersed in Shakespeare, and what they have to say is just awe-inspiring and moving. We always found it very moving.
Yeah.
How wow. passionate these people are about it. So all of that is to be enjoyed by anyone who wants to kind of see the interviews.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent.
Can I just say one thing?
You can.
Okay, because the quantity of people involved in making the film is quite extraordinary, and just about everyone gave up their time for free. So, including all the people who were involved on camera, in front of the camera, there's so many people on the back end of this that did so much. We had an amazing graphic designer artist who did all of the work for us and all the graphics in the film for nothing.
Wow.
And the quantity is extraordinary that he's done. Same with the animator who did the stuff in the film, the same. You know, the editor, we had two editors, one of them, Jeremy from GB Film, he finished cutting the film, but he's cut every single trailer, every single bit of video over the last 7 years that we've needed for free. Like, these are sort of the unsung heroes, and watch the credits, because all those people need to be seen.
Yeah,
it's like the music.
Matt Steele, who did the music, and
because Giles wrote the soundtrack as well.
Should mention there's a soundtrack available as well. Yeah,
right. The soundtrack, which is also available, you can kind of get that on the website and stuff. But Matt Steele, that helped to do the music, Ben Stark, who also is the other guy who cut the film. I mean, when you watch it, it's very much the two of us who went out and sort of filmed it. But then there's putting the whole film together, and that's where we've like had a team of sort of happy band of brothers.
And also Lion TV.
Right.
They were the one production company, because Lion TV produced Horrible Histories, and they, you know, Richard Bradley and Richard Shaw were the two guys that went, actually, we like this. We're up for kind of getting behind this. And without them, we wouldn't be here today, because we would never have got the money to complete the post part of it, and we would have never had this situation where it's available now. And so everyone's involved, and everyone is there to thank, and it's just that thing of, you don't always know it. You don't always see it when you watch a film. You think that...
But it's just the YouTube, it's so much more.
As I say, those credits are for good reason.
Just going back to the animation, it's also really quite a big part of your film as well. And just the lovely the skull going over. And it's, going back to storytelling, it's part of the storytelling. It's you know, and the playing going over and all that sort of stuff, which is great, because it was part of the storytelling of your film, so... So,
and it's the quickest way to get that point. You know, we were like, how do we take 5 minutes of going, oh, and we flew here and did that?
Indiana Jones.
You show, Indiana Jones or the Monty Python. You show a 10-second clip of something which says everything. And animation is the best way of doing that. Because
it's all about presenting in such a way which people are familiar with. There's something familiar about all of those animation things, and we're kind of... It puts people at ease, as opposed to saying I'm put off by this. It's the same with the music. You want music which is again as like honest as possible. So we wanted to have stuff which was acoustic guitars and acoustic instruments and horns and acoustic pianos that wasn't sort of electronic in any way. That actually people will be very kind of comfortable with. Don't have to worry about that, and yet provide some kind of emotional thing. So all of those things were people, you know, that our team that we kind of built that sort of helped us with all of that stuff.
And it's worth noting, sorry, I know we're just going on, so we can really talk with these two.
Yeah,
you just basically have to stop us, so I'm just saying you'll carry on. But basically, one of the things that happened with the music, which is everywhere we went, we sort of noted down what was being played, because we always listened to radio, we always listened to, you know, digital radio in America, music driving to Elsinore, and we knew we could never afford ever to like buy a track by Sammy Davis or buy a track by Frank Sinatra when we're going through New York, or buy that, you know, Gershwin track, or buy the Lalo Schifrin or that, whatever it is. And we were like, what we need to do, Giles, this is basically what happened, you need to write stuff that is feels the same to us. And so that's what he did.
But music was so important in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't write rock and roll. He wrote those very simple tunes. Acoustically would have been, obviously.
Yeah.
With the jig at the end of King Lear and that sort of stuff. So it's part of it anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Things which which the audience can feel very comfortable with. And also there's something in the music which there's a kind of progression to it. I mean, if you sort of looked at it, you might sort of recognize that. That's sort of neither here nor there for someone who's watching it. But the sense that it kind of starts off, it mirrors the journey that the two protagonists go on, which it starts off quite simple in arrangement. And then as you go on, you have trumpets and then you have a bit of harp coming in. And it kind of gets a bit more kind of complicated or intricate as their journey kind of sort of deepens. So we always felt that it was, you know, music is massively important in films. It can do such a good job emotionally. And for something which can be very unemotional, the presentation of Shakespeare and the academic side of Shakespeare, we wanted to have something which was open, honest, emotional, to do with feelings.
And fun.
And that made you feel good or tap your feet or make you laugh or all of that stuff.
Totally.
Well,
so,
we both loved it and it's both inspired us massively.
Brilliant.
Amazing.
And I hope it's going to inspire a lot of other people. I know it will. I know it's going to
make
a huge difference.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for talking. I've got one last question. Did you really bribe Judi Dench with a cake?
There's no... I wouldn't say bribery. Bribery is such a strong word.
It's a strong word on such a thing,
It's a strong word.
But is cake a good thing to use for big actresses?
Does that get you in a room?
What I'm saying is you can never use it again. Okay. Like, look, we with lots of different people, we wanted to find a way to bypass the heavy side of our industry and get to the light side of it. Chris Eccleston, I ran up to in the street, scared the bejesus out of him, and then asked him if we could speak to him, and then he was like, call my agent. Will you speak to us if I call your agent?
Well, that's the thing, is not only because obviously the agents get in the way and all that sort of stuff and it gets all scary and real and serious, but the fact that you know some of these guys and the fact that you can rock up in the middle of, like, going to a casting and say, we're doing this thing.
Yeah.
Do you want to do this
thing? So yes, we did send the cake to Judy, but it was sent in
two,
the
actually.
Yeah.
Was she it said only two?
I thought it was three.
Two. No, there were two.
I have it down as three. I'm basically, and we just had this thing of going, yeah, I thought it was three. But that idea of just going, this is what we're doing, and it references the lighthearted nature of the world that which we're trying to inhabit, and hopefully, well, that's what
it worked. Know,
that echoed. It echoed just something that said to her what we wanted to do. So yes, she did have cakes from us.
Excellent.
But the thing is that you have, you know, we were around central London, and so a lot of the actors that we wanted to speak to are just happen to be walking around, and you kind of see people. And of course, a lot of them are going to voiceovers, or they're going to the meeting with their agent, or they're going to film or whatever. So you can't just bound up to people like some lunatic sort of autograph
we
hunter.
We did that.
But, so but long, again, back to my original point, if once you've made that excuse me step, you know that you've got something which you believe in, that you feel you know why you're asking Bill Nighy or Christopher Eccleston what you're going to ask them, and you've got something to back it up. That's kind of what it is. We weren't just sort of bounding up to people, being nuisances.
Like happy golden retrievers. No,
you've got to be able to back it up with something, and you have to know
exactly, as Giles says, to the second what you were going to say, because someone comes up to you and you don't know them. Of course, you think there could be anything going on there, but you know, it's that thing of saying, if you've got 1 minute, this is what we're doing, da-da-da, I'll send you an email, da-da-da, will you read it, at least have a little think about it.
And it's, that just shows that you believed in what you were doing, and you believed right. there was a reason to do it, and a worthwhile,
right.
is a better word.
And we're not putting them under the pressure right then to have an answer either, which is would be absolutely the most horrific thing to ever do. They have to want to do it, you know. Can't force someone.
Awesome. So get out there and watch this documentary, because I really think
ShakespeareFilm.com,
and let us know what you think. If you like it, if you enjoy it, please let us know.
Oh yeah, if you do like it, actually leave a review on the iTunes website, because that will really help us. It will really be, it's, you know,
tweet about it, because at the end of the day,
is there a Twitter account for it?
Yeah, there's a Twitter account, MusaFireFilm.
Yeah,
at MusaFireFilm.
Great.
We're still an independent production.
It's us.
Just the two of us. So we need to sort of spread the word and let people know about it.
And we've got a Facebook account as well, for anyone that's on that. Just MusaFire.
Just MusaFire.
Excellent.
Great.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks, guys, for coming on the show.
So, thanks for having us.
That's Don't Be So Dramatic for this week. I'm Steve Bradley.
I'm Jason B. Moore.
I'm Dan Poole.
And I'm Giles Torreira.
Don't Be So Dramatic.